Well, I'm very happy to have Massimo Piliucci here with me today to talk on Blogging Heads. And since it's traditional to do introductions, Massimo, maybe why don't you introduce yourself and then I'll introduce myself and then we can get started.
Sure, it's a pleasure to be here. I am a philosopher at City University of New York. My background is actually in evolutionary biology. I had a former career in that field, and then I switched to philosophy of science. Some of my interests include also the concept of pseudoscience and how it interacts with the general understanding of science by the public.
And my name is Daniel Kaufman. I'm a professor and program director in the philosophy department at Missouri State University. I wanted to talk with you, Massimo, because of a massive discussion thread that erupted on your new webzine, Scientia Salon, on the comments that Neil deGrasse Tyson made recently about philosophy, some very negative comments. And he joins a number of others who have relatively recently made such comments. So that's what sort of motivated my interest in speaking with you. In addition to Tyson, Lawrence Krauss made some news with some quite critical remarks about philosophy. And even Stephen Hawking made some pretty negative comments. And I'm wondering what you make of all of this.
Well, it's an interesting trend, and it's actually a fairly novel trend, at least among physicists. By the way, I should say, although you've mentioned only physicists, there are some biologists that have made similar noises in the recent past. But I think the physicist community, or I should say, sections of the physics community, is actually been particularly vocal about their disregard for philosophy in recent years. And it's an interesting phenomenon because until not that long ago, let's say until a few decades ago, physicists and philosophers of science got along perfectly fine. And in fact, a lot of the major physicists of the 20th century, from Einstein to Bohr, prided themselves in an understanding of philosophy and in an interactive dialogue with philosophers. So this is a fairly new phenomenon, although there's been prior occurrences of it. For instance, Richard Feynman's famous comment that philosophy is as relevant to physics as ornithology is to birds. Yeah, which is very funny, but it's also ironic because as it turns out, of all people, Feynman actually indulged in quite a bit of what I would call philosophical writing in his career. And of course, one can come up with little counters pointing out, for instance, that actually, as it turns out, ornithologists are crucial for the survival of birds. But, whatever, that's a different issue. Anyway, back to your main question. Yeah, it is a little bit puzzling because, I know Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's been on my podcast a couple of times. I know Lawrence Krauss. And I don't know Stephen Hawking, I should say, but I read him whenever he publishes something for the public. And it is interesting that they do make these kind of comments, like specifically, for instance, Hawking said that philosophy has been a dead field for the past 100 years. deGrasse Tyson echoed that by basically saying that philosophers have stopped being relevant when they stopped essentially furthering the advancement of science. Again, also he puts that point somehow for some reasons to about 100 years ago, and the same. And Krauss has made comments about pretty much along the same lines. Now the question is, well, first of all, I actually bet I and I've asked two of these people directly and did not get a straight answer, but my bet is that actually all of these physicists have probably never read a technical philosophy paper in their lives, so they literally don't know what they're talking about. Because if they did, then they wouldn't make that sort of statement, which is bizarre for a major reason. It is simply not the business of philosophy, even a philosophy of science, to further science. In the sense of, in the very specific sense of helping scientists figuring out things about how the world works. I mean, we have science for that, and it works very well, thank you very much. So it doesn't need any help from philosophy, and in fact, philosophy is not structured to provide that sort of help. philosophy of science in particular is a way to look at the doings of science from the outside, specifically from the epistemic warrant perspective. So we want to know as philosophers how science works logically. Is it that scientists take to be sufficient evidence for their theories, how they construct their theories, that sort of stuff. Similarly, we have other fields that study science from the outside, but from different perspectives. We have sociology of science, for instance, that of course looks at the social interactions as of scientists as human beings. We have history of science, which looks at how science has actually, scientific controversies and progress have actually unfolded throughout time. Now, I never heard deGrasse Tyson wondering, you know, why sociology or history of science haven't made a contribution to, you know, string theory or cosmology recently, because that would be really a silly question to ask. And I don't see why he doesn't see that that's just as silly in the case of philosophy of science.
Do you think that maybe some of their resistance has been with respect to very specific developments in philosophy of science? I'm thinking specifically of things like Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions and some of the work of Paul Feyerabend that have at least suggested perhaps a certain sort of postmodernist attitudes about the entire enterprise of science. Do you think that that may be what they're reacting to and not philosophy of science as a whole?
Yeah, I think there is something to be said for that. In fact, when you do push these physicists, they typically, the first thing they bring up is postmodernism. I actually think that most of them know about Feyerabend and about Kuhn. They only know about paradigm shifts. So I don't think actually they link him particularly strongly to postmodernism. But yes, postmodernism is very much on their minds. But again, that to me only shows a significant amount of ignorance for public figures of that caliber. We're talking about, first of all, a philosophy of science, if we're talking Kuhn or Feyerabend, that it's already, you know, 40 years old. So imagine if, as a philosopher, I were commenting on the science of 40 years ago as if it were just happening. So that's strange in and of itself. But also, of course, they don't seem to realize that the best arguments against postmodernism, which was never as prevalent in philosophy as they seem to think it was, are actually philosophical. I mean, you know, the famous science wars of the 1990s, for instance, were fought, you know, between extreme postmodernist readings of science and epistemic relativism and the scientists on the other side, were actually fought mostly by philosophers. A bunch of philosophers of science in particular were definitely on the side of scientists. So it still seems puzzling to me that that's where this is coming from. I think you're right. I think that that is at least part of the source for these dismissal or downright animosity toward philosophy, but it seems very strange and rooted in, again, a misunderstanding. And I know I've used the word ignorance already three times in 5 minutes, but, you know, that's what it is in my mind.
Yeah, I think, you know, they don't differentiate between continental and analytic philosophy, for one. And so, right. You know, a lot of the people that I think that they're maybe reacting hostilely against, and you remember the Alan Sokol social text fiasco, in which Alan Sokol fooled a postmodern journal into publishing what was essentially gibberish. I think that they perhaps don't know enough about philosophy to actually know that people who do philosophy of science were laughing as hard at social text and the kind of, exactly, as the scientists were.
And it's funny, you mentioned Alan. Alan and I have been in touch recently, and he actually has contributed a wonderful three-part piece, long essays for Scientia Salon recently. And, you know, he understands very well the value of philosophy and philosophy of science. So it's kind of ironic that the guy who is a physicist, who actually was a major player in the science wars of the 90s, he understands actually the value of physics much better than people that were actually not involved in these things. I mean, I don't recall anything by Hawkins, deGrasse Tyson, Krauss, or anybody of this group during that period.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts as to why physicists in particular seem to be on this hobby horse? I mean, I know that Dawkins has said some critical things, and Sam Harris has said some critical things about philosophy, but they also seem more inclined to be a bit more tolerant. I've seen Dawkins on panels with philosophers on the subject of naturalism, right. And I know that Harris has a degree in philosophy. Do you have any guesses or thoughts as to why physicists in particular seem to be banging this drum?
There are a couple of things to be said there. First of all, I rarely hear the word Dawkins intolerant in the same sentence. But but nonetheless, you're right, because I've seen actually Dawkins in the presence of philosophers, and including myself, and acting much more humbly than he does when he's not in the presence of philosophers. And I think that's an interesting observation about his, you know, character, I suppose. As far as Harris is concerned, yes, he has an undergraduate degree in philosophy, but, you know, he's not actually even a practicing scientist. I mean, essentially, he's at this point a full-time author, which is, you know, nothing wrong with that. I mean, good, you know, more power to him. But I don't actually count him as a practicing scientist. I do think that there are a number of other scientists outside of physics, mostly biologists. Dawkins is an example. Jerry Coyne is another one. He's an evolutionary biologist, although Jerry is much more careful, actually, than Dawkins or Harris, for that matter. But you are right that it is mostly the physicists, or at least the physicists are particularly vocal about it. I mean, Steven Weinberg, Nobel for physics for several years ago, actually wrote a book, if you remember, in the early 90s called Dreams of a Final Theory. And in that book, there is an entire chapter entitled Against Philosophy. Yeah, like, wow, what's going on there? Now, I suspect in some sense, this is a result of the fact that philosophers are doing their job well. Ever since Socrates, we've been self-described, gadflies. We just love it to, you know, stick it to other people and tell other people what they should think and whatnot, right? I mean, you can argue that I switched from science to philosophy for that reason. I really love the idea of, you know, being a gadfly. And that comes with its perils. Hopefully, none of us will see the, you know, meet the same end as Socrates. But nonetheless, I mean, for instance, let's Krauss, and specifically, you know, he got really pissed and at a review that of his book, A Universe from Nothing, that was published in the New York Times by a philosopher,
David Albert.
And that's right. And you know, I read the review, and the review was honestly pretty harsh. But I also thought that, you know, Albert had good points. Essentially, Albert said, look, this is all very interesting, but you're not actually explaining how the universe came out from nothing. You're actually explaining how the universe may have come out, because this is pretty speculative anyway, out of fluctuations in a quantum field. Now, a quantum field is not nothing. It is something that has properties. And if something has properties, it is not nothing. Albert was accusing Krauss of doing a bait and switch to his readers. And the funny thing is that Krauss actually admitted as such in an interview, in a follow-up interview in The Atlantic magazine, where, you know, I can't quote him by memory, but, you know, it's easy to look it up on the internet and find the exact quote. Krauss basically said, well, yeah, I don't really mean to say that the universe came from, you know, that we know how the universe came from nothing. But, you know, that's the kind of title that sells books. Okay. I mean, sure. But it's disingenuous to then, you know, take it up against the philosopher who basically just pointed out that this was a bait and switch, when you actually do agree that it is what it was. So sometimes it's about criticism. And, you know, this goes back to the whole postmodernist thing, right? I mean, if these physicists actually confuse postmodernism and continental philosophy, which of course are different things in themselves, and not all continental philosophers are postmodernists.
Right.
But if you confuse those two things, then they confuse those with philosophy of science, then you're apt to just dismiss everything and being annoyed by anybody who labels themselves a philosopher. But I think that's a dangerous attitude. And I've used this, the word anti-intellectual, in reference to what deGrasse Tyson and others have been doing. And, you know, people have called me to task, saying, well, these are major public intellectuals. How can you possibly accuse them of being anti-intellectual? I don't think there's any contradiction there. Anti-intellectualism is an attitude that can be applied or focused on specific subsets of human culture. And I think that when a prominent intellectual, a physicist, a cosmologist, or a biologist, actually goes out and dismisses in public an entire field of intellectual inquiry and endeavor, he is behaving as an anti-intellectual. That doesn't mean that he's anti-intellectual about everything, demonstrably not in the case of, you know, Neil, for instance. But I think that that is certainly a case of anti-intellectualism, and it's disturbing for that reason, I think.
Yeah, and I guess maybe the reason why it would be physicists and biologists more than, let's say, chemists or others is that they're more likely to be talking about topics that at least philosophy addresses in the abstract, right? Things like
That's
the
right.
origins of the existence of reality or the nature of human beings, or whereas philosophy doesn't say very much that would go across what people in chemistry study or people in other fields study.
That's right. I mean, let me give you a recent example. I was in the audience recently at the World Science Festival here in New York, and I saw a debate between Brian Greene, who is, you know, a famous proponent of string theory and related efforts in theoretical physics, and Jim Bagot, who is the author. He has a physics background, but he's an independent author, and he published recently a book called Farewell to Reality about the status of fundamental physics. And the debate got really testy very, very, very soon because, you know, Bagot pointed out that some physicists are in the process of actually trying to reshape and redefine what it means to do science, what counts as evidence in science, which, of course, is obviously an inherently philosophical issue, right? And the problem comes out of the fact that string theory, famously, has been very, very, very promising approach to reconciling in general relativity and quantum mechanics, which make some predictions that are at odds with each other, which means that we know that there's something wrong going on there, something missing at least. So string theory back in the 80s and early 90s was proposed as one way to eventually unify and resolve these contradictions. It has not delivered. It has not delivered empirically. I mean, there hasn't been a single novel empirical prediction that has been tested as far as string theory is concerned. And, you know, string theorists, like every theorist would do, is started making excuses. You know, well, we're going to get there. It's going to take some time. Right. You know, we need high energy levels, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But after a few decades of doing that, you know, the excuse is beginning to wear thin. And so some string theorists actually have argued now that because the theory is not actually a single theory, but a complex landscape, theoretical landscape, that comes in something like here this, 10 to the 500 different variations. And let me repeat that, 10 to the 500. That's one followed by 500 zeros, different versions of string theory. Now, there is no way in hell we're going to ever be able to test a theory, you know, that comes in that many different flavors, down to pinpoint, you know, the one that might in fact describe reality. So faced with that, some string theorists, not all of them, but some string theorists are basically biting the bullet and say, look, you know, we need to move to a post, you know, physics, a way of doing science that it's different, where, you know, we accept and work on theories if they are coherent and mathematically confirmed as opposed to be empirically confirmed. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. That would be a major departure from the way science has been done, at least since Galileo. Yeah. And so, of course, philosophers have something to say about it. And, of course, the physicists don't like it.
Well, it renders string theory essentially a mathematics. It's not a scientific theory anymore. It becomes simply a mathematical theory, correct?
Yes, you know what else it makes it? I'm about to use a word that really pisses off physicists. It makes it metaphysics.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it makes it mathematically grounded metaphysics.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what metaphysics is, right? It's the attempt to derive truth about the world a priori by deduction.
Yeah.
And that's precisely what string theorists are doing right now. Now, I don't actually have particular animosity against metaphysicians. You know, sometimes they do silly things. They say silly things just like everybody else. But I don't reject metaphysics as a worthwhile intellectual pursuit. But a lot of scientists do, and particularly the physicists we're talking
Yes.
about. So it's obvious why they get, you know, upset when you accuse them in turn of essentially indulging in metaphysics.
Yeah. Something I wanted to bring up in this context, and maybe you can broaden our discussion a little bit. This reminded me, you said that there's something a bit unprecedented about this, but at another level, it reminded me a lot of the Leavis-Snow controversy, The two cultures, the 1959 Reed lecture that Snow gave at Cambridge, which sort of started a fight between the scientific community on the one hand, and at the time the target was literary intellectuals. And that itself was a reprise of a very similar debate between T.H. Huxley and
That's
Matthew
right.
Arnold in the 19th century.
That's right.
I'm wondering, do you think this is another, is this a conflict that's sort of perennial, that every 100 years we're going to have this argument? Or do you think that there's something different about what's going on now?
So yes and no. It certainly seems to be a recurring argument. And in fact, it's getting more frequent, I suppose, because Snow, as you said, published only 50 years ago. And you can also see it as sort of in an even broader perspective as the latest example of the conflict between two different ways of understanding or pursuing knowledge. I mean, and if you see it that way, it goes back to the skating criticism that Plato and Socrates had for the sophists. You know, so we're not talking about anything new here. It goes back at least 2.5 millennia in that sense. But there is something new in another sense. Just let's take the most two recent instantiations, the one that we've been talking about mostly so far, you know, the physicist and to some extent biologists, modern biologists and physicists, dismissing philosophy versus the C.P. Snow 1959 essay. As you pointed out, Snow was actually criticizing the humanists at that time. The sciences were the ones that were on the up and coming, but not yet affirmed.
That's right.
Not yet established. You know, most, you know, real culture was in fact humanistic. And Snow was rightly, by the way, chastising his colleagues in the humanities for dismissing fundamental notions of science as just technical. And famously he said, you know, you think that somebody is ignorant, is hopelessly ignorant if he doesn't know about Shakespeare. True, but you don't seem to realize that you're just as hopelessly ignorant if you don't understand the second principle of thermodynamics.
Right, right.
Which I think it's also true. So what has changed in the meantime, of course, is that in the last half century, the sciences have definitely overtaken the humanities as the central set of disciplines on university campuses. They bring in a lot of money, especially during the Cold War, of course. They brought in a lot of money to universities. Some universities these days just couldn't survive probably without the large amounts of grants that scientific research brings in. There's a lot of emphasis on the so-called STEM disciplines, you know, science and technology, engineering and math, and for good reasons. This is not, you know, I'm not about to criticize that sort of approach. But now it's been basically over the last 15 years that the table has turned, and it's the humanities that are on the defensives. So you constantly see humanities departments being threatened with closure or downsizing in their faculty. You know, language departments are disappearing right and left because they're considered useless or a waste of money by university administrators. Don't even get me started on that one because that's a whole different conversation. But and philosophy, of course, is since it's traditionally been in, housed in the humanities, essentially falls into the same general category. And in fact, it was kind of interesting. As I said in the beginning, my early career was in the sciences. And for 20 plus years, I was an evolutionary biologist. And then when I moved to philosophy full time, one of the first things I realized was that unlike any science department that I've seen, the web pages of philosophy departments typically have an entry that says "Why philosophy?" where people try to to convince prospective students that it's a good idea to study philosophy. You know, there's good evidence, you know, empirical evidence, in fact, data driven evidence.
I did that. I had to do that on my own website, my own department's
exactly.
website.
And it's, you know, I did it as well, and it's actually interesting because in so doing, I actually learned a few things that I didn't know about the value of the humanities and particularly philosophy. Like, philosophy majors, for instance, tend to be highly employable in a variety of different fields. They actually make a pretty good living after leaving college because they basically learn highly portable skills such as critical thinking, critical reading, writing, that sort of stuff. But of course, the issue still is, the sciences are in control at this point, and at least for the foreseeable future, is going to go that way, which raises the question of, you know, why bother being, you know, attacking the humanities, which after all have been on the retreat for the last, you know, decade or two. They're not bringing any money or very little money, comparatively speaking, on campus. They're certainly not a threat for university positions or anything like that. So it's like, why bother? Why are you so annoyed?
Yeah.
Except, as I said earlier, because some philosophers in particular tend to be, you know, tend to act like their profession demands, like gadflies, and nobody likes to be told that they're thinking in a not particularly straightforward way. So,
yeah, you know, I agree with you, and obviously the scenario in which Snow wrote was one in which British education, in particular, was dominated by classical literature, and
right.
And it was also tied into the class system.
Right.
Which is also part of what Snow was reacting against. But there is one element of Snow's critique that I think is directly relevant to at least a strand of what I'm hearing out of some of the science critics today. And that is the belief that science and the scientific worldview provides us with everything we need for the development of good society. The good life,
right.
humane culture, and the like. This idea almost that a morality and a politics naturally falls out of the scientific worldview. Lionel Trilling, who wrote probably the best reply to Snow, because Leavis's reply was a bit intemperate, but Lionel Trilling said that Snow seemed to have forgotten that politics exists, and I've heard both Harris and Krauss and some of the others who seem to think that we don't need to have any sort of discourse or deliberation on the subject of values and ends for the sake of developing better society, more humane culture. And that I see a similarity with Snow. There's this very naive sort of notion that that sort of we're just all sort of instinctive utilitarians and progressive liberals.
Right. That's right. At least deGrasse Tyson doesn't actually make that mistake. I mean, he actually recognizes that outside of philosophy of science, philosophy does have a lot to say, particularly about issues such as justice and ethics and so on, you know, political philosophy and so forth. You're right. There seems to be in certain quarters, Harris is the quintessential example, I think, this pretty naive idea that values automatically come out of just knowing the facts, right? I mean, if you know facts about human biology or neurobiology or whatever, or physics even, then you'll be able to figure out exactly what sort of social system works and what kind of, you know, how do you resolve ethical dilemmas and so on and so forth, which is, I think, nonsense on stilts. You know, no philosopher, I think, would argue that facts, and especially scientifically grounded facts, are irrelevant to those discussions. I mean, any good ethicist, any good political philosopher, and so on and so forth, will pay a lot of attention to facts on the ground. But the facts by themselves don't actually, you know, grossly underdetermine, to use a philosophical catchphrase, our ethical systems. So we still need to think critically about our ethics, our moral philosophy, our political philosophy, and so on. And there are different ways of doing it, utilitarianism, of course, being only one of them. And even that one comes in a variety of different flavors, as you know. And all of that complexity and nuance is swept away by people like Harris, who just don't seem to consider it either relevant or interesting. But I think it's just because they don't get it, despite Harris' undergraduate degree in philosophy. So that is part of what's going on there. The other thing is, in terms of sort of the relationship between fact and values, is that it's very hard for me to take seriously somebody who thinks that the facts themselves are theoretically, you know, independent of any theoretical background or assumptions. You know, if there's one thing that we learned through philosophy, from philosophy of science during the 20th century, is that there's no such a thing as a fact. You know, all facts, all pieces of information about the world are actually embedded,
yeah,
and they make sense only within a certain theoretical framework.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that it's all, you know, everything goes, you come up with your theory, and then you can pick your facts. But this understanding actually goes back even to Darwin himself. I mean, Darwin famously wrote a letter to a friend of his at some point when he expressed his frustration about people who don't seem to understand that there's no such thing as a fact, that facts only make sense in light of a particular theory. And so what's going on here is that the scientist who claims that the facts will give us all the answers, A, is making the mistake of, you know, sort of not understanding that there's quite a bit more going on in terms of values and understanding than just the facts. But also he seems to, even more problematically, assume a theoretical independence of facts, which is simply not there. You know, theoretically independent facts are just a random collection of bits of information about the world. You know, they're not facts.
Yeah.
They become such only once we deploy certain ways of looking at things. And then you have to ask the question, well, where are those ways of looking at things coming from? And now you're already back into philosophy.
Yeah. I mean, there's a well-known slogan in philosophy that observation is theory laden. And so it's not even clear that there are observations without theoretical considerations, which is, I guess, partly why some people tried at some point to retreat to something like sense data, the idea that one could completely neutrally describe the object of an experience. But I don't think anybody takes that seriously today.
No, they shouldn't. If they understand anything about neurobiology or philosophy of mind, they really shouldn't.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, I think there is also lurking, and I sort of am going to leave Harris out because
sure.
I more and more get the impression that he's just really a popularizer and I don't think understands the subjects very well at all. But Krauss has
said – Oh, you just got yourself into trouble with that one, but yes, that's okay.
I think I'll cope.
Yes.
I'm not important enough for him to care about. But Krauss, who's a very serious guy, I mean, in his field, has said very similar things. And I'm going to get to the subject of your webzine in a little bit, but I want to just bring this element in. I noticed even in some of the discussions there almost seems to be an impatience on the part of the very hardcore science people with the very idea of discussing matters, even of value, in ordinary language.
Right.
I'm wondering whether there's a certain, they get so wrapped up in the theoretical discussion that they sort of forget that there also has to be a political discussion. I mean, at the end of the day, when we're talking about questions of values and questions of whether we should cut people off of food stamps or whether we should have mandatory minimum sentences, or whether at some point, if we want to get better policies, we need to make political arguments. We need to make arguments in the public arena.
Right.
And those have to be couched in ordinary language. And one of the things that philosophy does really well is address such questions in ordinary language, but in a somewhat rigorous way. And I guess I don't understand that impact. Could they really not realize that at the end of the day, any question of value ultimately has to be brought into the arena of politics and public discourse?
Well, sometimes when I read comments on my own webzine, I feel like I'm in an episode of The Big Bang Theory, and I play the part of Penny. You know, so it's like, wait a minute. So there's all these geeks, very, very, you know, bright people. I mean, some of the commentaries there are actually longer than the posts, and the posts themselves are pretty long. I mean, I don't publish anything that's less than 2,000 words long, and some of them actually are as long as 5,000 or 6,000. But some of the commentaries end up being, you know, a lot longer actually than the original post, and they're very thoughtful. I mean, I actually spend an inordinate amount of time, don't tell my dean, but an inordinate amount of time, you know, reading or going through and sometimes responding and sort of counter-commenting because I learn a lot. There's a lot of interesting comments being made and a lot of stuff that, you know, challenge mine or other authors' claims in a thoughtful way. But you're right. At some point, you do get this nagging feeling that these are people, you know, there's a subgroup of people that read that webzine, and I think they're representative of sort of a broader chunk of what is sometimes referred to as the skeptic movement or the skeptic and atheist movement, who really see science as the pinnacle of human understanding and wisdom. You know, knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, which I would argue are three different things, although related. And therefore, they see any attempt to sort of bring it down to something that the general public can understand, and also bring it slightly a little bit away from the technical data, which are important, but into something more like a comprehensive understanding and discussion of certain issues. They just resist that very much. As soon as you move away from the straight science, they feel like you're becoming already a postmodernist and you're a fuzzy thinker, and you know you're philosophizing. And that's a term of abuse in some quarters. It's like, well, no, as you pointed out, this is one of the things that philosophy actually does best, and science arguably not so much. You know, philosophers have had always a direct or indirect impact on societal discussions. I mean, one of the most recent examples probably is Peter Singer's impact on the whole idea of animal rights. Or animal welfare, to be more correct, more precise. I mean, he wrote the book originally in the 70s about, you know, the animal welfare, and it took time for that to have an impact. But essentially, pretty much all of the arguments that you hear today and that are increasingly accepted in society at large about animal welfare, they all come, you know, from Singer's book or other authors who have written about similar things. So philosophy clearly, especially when brought out into the field of public opinion, actually has a crucial role to play. And I'm really puzzled by the fact that not only some scientists, but in fact, even a number of philosophers don't get it. There's a lot of philosophers who actually frown, you know, several of my colleagues actually frown on any kind of, you know, public engagement. You know, you can argue that one of the reasons I've been doing a lot of public writing and all that is because I have tenure and I'm a full professor, and you know, what can they do anyway? You know, it's not like my career is in jeopardy, and if this is what I decide it's worth my time, that's what I do. But there's a lot of colleagues, especially not so young colleagues, who just don't understand that the relevance of philosophy, the continuing relevance of philosophy, actually depends greatly on engaging the public, engaging policymakers, and, you know, making, going out there and doing what Socrates was doing 2.5 millennia ago.
Or what John Locke was doing.
That's right.
Know, I mean, our own, the systems of government we live under.
Yeah.
We're in a sense blueprinted by the philosophers of the Enlightenment. And I'm stunned.
Yeah, I know. It's stunning, right? So there's Locke, and then you can say John Stuart Mill about women's rights. You know, the list goes on and on and on. In fact, so much so that I put out a sort of somewhat sarcastic video recently on my YouTube channel, which is entitled "What Has Philosophy Done for Us?" And it starts out with a recap of the famous Monty Python skit in The Life of Brian, where you have these conspirators, you know, for the liberation of Judea, who talk about the Romans, and one of them at some point says, you know, that's right, because what did the Romans do for us anyway? And so somebody in the back of the room says, well, you know, they built temples. Yes, but other than temples, what did the Romans do for us? Well, they paved roads. Okay, but other than the temples and the roads, what did the Romans do for us? Well, you know, education. You know, by 5 minutes later, the list is so long. It's like, okay, well, fine. The Romans did do something for us. And the same goes for philosophy. It's just really bizarre that that people don't seem to appreciate it better. And I mean, to some extent, I do fault our own colleagues who don't do enough to remind people of the relevance of philosophy, not just throughout the millennia, but even much more recently.
It's I think partly also a sign of the extent to which philosophy has developed its own aristocracy that is somewhat immunized from what the rest of us are feeling, the pressures to justify our place in the academy. Right. You know, where I am, at an unranked school, large public university in the lower Midwest, I have to engage the public all the time to justify my place, our place in the university. And I almost wonder whether, because philosophy has a certain elite and a number of elite institutions, which a lot of the sort of the top people are concentrated, that they've almost been able to develop a kind of a cloistered mentality at exactly the time when the humanities are being threatened in the academy. Right. And you'd think that there would be a greater call to go out in the public and engage the public questions.
Right. Although Honestly, I do think maybe I don't want to be too much of an optimist, but I do think things are changing for the better. I think it was Max Planck at some point who said that new scientific ideas are accepted not because scientists change their mind and they're so fair-minded, but because they retire and die. And I think that something similar can be said for the sort of the attitude of philosophers toward the general public. I think the things are changing, and the reason I'm saying this is because I see an increasing number of young philosophers, some of our own graduate students, and certainly some of my younger colleagues who are on a tenure track, so not even tenured faculty, who actually do spend a significant amount of time, on their own blogs or participating to initiatives such as Ask a Philosopher on the web, or producing videos and lectures that go public, or contributing to the many, 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 many books at this point. That have been put out by a number of publishers over the last few years that use popular culture to introduce people to philosophy. I mean, I contributed to several of those, including, by the way, a chapter on philosophy and the Big Bang Theory, the TV show, not the cosmological theory. So I do think things are changing. Of course, it takes time. It takes a generation. It takes incentives, from the inside as well as from the outside. One of the things that I've done as a tenured faculty who has served on promotion and tenure committees, I have stretched the importance and trying to convince my colleagues that it was important to count things like blogs and public outreach in general as at least as a service component, and in fact as a very crucial service component in evaluating a candidate for tenure or promotion. Much, much more important, certainly, that what normally gets counted as service, which is, being on yet another essentially useless university committee.
Well, given that we've come to the question of philosophy in the public, and since we're getting near the hour, maybe let's talk a little bit about what you've been doing. So you for a while had a quite well-read and heavily discussed blog called Rationally Speaking, and now you've just you've stop doing that, and you've designed this webzine, as you call it, called Scientia Salon. Could you maybe talk a little bit about, and I'm sure that they will provide links, the Blogging Heads always provides links to these things so people can check it out. First of all, why did you decide to change from the earlier to the format to the latter, and what more generally, what is your idea behind the new webzine?
So rationally speaking, you're right. I've been going on for a significant amount of time, actually. It started in 2000 before there actually were blogs. It was called at the time an internet column. It was syndicated on a number of websites. Then it became a blog, and by the end of its course, almost 15 years later, we had probably, I say we because although I did the majority, the bulk of the writing, I had over the years a number of collaborators, and so we managed to publish something like 1,200 posts that became longer and longer over time. I mean, it started out as these short little things, and then eventually, if you look at the latest entries, they're typically around 2,000 words or more, which is more than twice an op-ed piece in the New York Times. It was a good forum. It had a lot of followers, and it's still out there, by the way. People want to check the archives. It's still there, and there's a lot of interesting material there. But I felt like I needed a different direction and to make a statement of some sort. In favor of a more, even more overt public intellectualism, I suppose. And so I started this webzine, as I call it. Of course, it looks like a blog, but it's a webzine. Trust me. And it's called Scientia Salon or Scientia Salon. Actually, the two pronunciations are both good as far as we know from Latin. Scientia means knowledge in Latin in the broadest possible sense. So it means the kind of knowledge and understanding that comes from practicing the natural sciences, the social sciences, history, philosophy, and mathematics and logic. So it's to me the choice of the title itself sort of signaled, and of course the word salon comes from the places for public intellectualism that became so famous during the Enlightenment in France and other places in Europe. So the title signals that what the idea is. This is a place for people who are interested in intellectual discourse, in-depth intellectual discourse, to come in and contribute to that discourse. Although I do write a number of essays for Scientia Salon, I have a constant call for submissions, and so I treat it as a magazine basically. If anybody has something interesting to say at the interface between science and philosophy, they can send me a manuscript, and then it will go through basically peer review. I mean, I'll look at it, I'll ask opinions of different people, and then I decide whether to publish it or not. And then the discussions that are going on there are very thoughtful. The forum is strictly moderated. I mean, very rarely something slips my checking, and the level, and you can see the difference. I mean, unlike many blogs, not all, of course, but unlike many blogs, the discussion is Scientia Salon. Is really of high quality. There is no name calling. There is no trolling. There is no nothing of that kind of stuff. It's a really congenial environment for people who are interested in intellectual discourse. So I'm devoting a significant amount of time, first of all, to this. I also raised some money. I have an anonymous donor, for instance, who has contributed a few thousand dollars recently to have social networking campaigns to raise the profile of Scientia Salon. And I'm hoping that it's going to be eventually established as one of the places where you go on the internet for a thoughtful, in-depth discussion on science, philosophy, and whatever they have to sell, to say to each other.
I wonder that I've been on it, and I've participated right. myself to a certain degree, and I've actually had a few of my less tempered posts moderated.
Sorry.
Oh no, that's quite all right. I fully expected it. But let me ask you, there's a level of difficulty in trying to quote unquote speak to the public. And I almost wonder whether one winds up inevitably falling between two poles, neither of which is really what one wanted, you know. Either you're sort of really talking to the public, in which case a lot of the discussion then becomes uneducated,
right?
And in which you have to pitch what you do at a much lower level, or you pitch it at a quite a highbrow level, but then in that case you're really not talking to the public. And I'm wondering, do you feel a little bit perhaps that there's a risk that this is just going to become another web entity in which highly educated people, often professional intellectuals, as well as a mixture of amateur enthusiasts and maybe some cranks, excuse me, engage in highly technical conversations? Because some of the conversations on there are quite technical.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Let me start from the end. Yes, some of the conversations are actually fairly technical, but I'm counting on the fact that the posts themselves are not. I try to tell my writers that they need to talk to the public. Now, however, that said, they do need, and that goes back to this goes back to the initial part of your question. They need to talk to a public. The audience here is not the general public, as in, you know, undescript, you know, whoever happens to wander on the internet will read this stuff and benefit from it. This is is a particular subset of the general public. It's aimed at people who do take intellectual discourse seriously and who are sophisticated enough to, you know, digest and think about material that it's not graduate level stuff. It's not technical. It's not, you know, peer reviewed level things. But it's much higher than you know, certainly, unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that you do find on the internet. And now you're right. There is a danger there in targeting that audience. But this is the same audience that I target with my books, my so-called public outreach books, right? I mean, I've written a number of technical books, which, as you probably know, typically, you know, they're considered a success if they're read by 2,000 people.
Right.
You know, a technical book in either science, frankly, or philosophy, it's, you know, if it reaches the 2,000 copies, the publisher, you know, opens up the champagne and they're very happy. And a technical paper, it fares even worse. I mean, there are data there out there, for instance, showing that fully 1/3 to 50% of high level, you know, technical papers in the sciences, for instance, published on the best journals are never cited once, which is, means that for all effective purposes, they're lost. They're not useful. And, you know, if maybe a dozen or two dozen people read my technical philosophy papers, that's a lucky day. In fact, that's a lucky year. So that's one extreme that you were talking about. The other extreme, so the ultra popular sort of audience, is something that I decided I simply cannot reach. I don't write for those people. You know, none of my books have ever been and probably never will be a bestseller because I just don't write to that level. And by the way, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with writing with that level. On the contrary, I think that if you can do it, we should be able to write, you know, people should write at all levels, including not just that sort of broader general public, but especially and most importantly, perhaps, an entire category of people who we keep ignoring as intellectual, which is children. There are very few good people, good books in either science or philosophy for children. And that's one of the main reasons I think in this country we lose out on most of the new generation every time, because, you know, on the other hand, the pseudoscientists and the, you know, religious fundamentalists and all that realize perfectly well that they need to target young children. And they do it so very effectively. So there is a whole range of possible audiences. The one that I decided, is most appropriate for my writings, both in terms of, Ciencia Salon and also in my outreach books, is the, intelligent audience with at least a college degree who is interested in certain more or less in-depth discussions. Now you say, well, what effect is that going to have? Well, my hope is that beyond just generating an interesting sort of internal discussion among those people, that audience is large enough that then in and of itself, those people are going to talk to other people at different levels, and there's going to be this sort of cascade effect, right? And the numbers, as far as I can tell them so far, do give me at least some comfort. I mean, the Rationally Speaking blog and now Ciencia Salon reach regularly, you know, tens of thousands of people every week. My podcast, Rationally Speaking, is downloaded by, you know, tens of thousands of people. In a couple of peak episodes, we reached 100,000 people. That's a significant amount of readership and listenership. It's certainly much, much more than any academic can possibly hope for their technical writings. And again, the idea is that hopefully that will generate a cascade effect. You know, these people in turn talk to other people in their own spheres of social influence. And so you get this ricochet effect where your ideas, if not directly your writings, percolate and go in different directions. I mean, I realize that this may sound optimistic, but you know, I'm sticking with it.
Well, you have to be optimistic, otherwise we don't get up in the morning.
That's right.
So I guess, you know, the last thing I would ask then is on the, you know, Ciencia Salon is focused on the intersection of science and philosophy and aiming at this sort of educated, but not specialist audience. The question then is, you know, for the subject matter that has to do more with the intersection between philosophy and, let's say, politics and public affairs,
right.
You know, it's obviously, I think, very important. And I'm always heartened when I see philosophers in op-ed pages in newspapers,
right.
And in magazines like Time or Newsweek, et cetera. But I'm wondering whether it's even possible in an age of mass democracy to have the engagement of the intellectuals with the public life that you had back in the Enlightenment, such that there could be such a direct effect. I'm wondering if that's even possible today, or if we just have not yet developed maybe the medium in which to do it. Maybe the internet is still too indiscriminate.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there are a couple of answers to that. First of all, there is a number of outlets out there, probably the most prominent being The Stone, the New York Times philosophy blog,
yes.
That actually does precisely what you're talking about. They, you know, they try to write for a very broad, obviously still educated, you know, these are New York Times readers,
yes.
But nonetheless, you know, a very broad audience. New York Times is the most popular newspaper in the world, and they're doing that. You know, they're writing on issues of practical importance. I mean, they're writing often about politics you know, social justice or social issues more generally. By the way, we do touch on that as well at Ciencia Salon, but now it's not the main focus. The main focus is science. So in some sense, this is already happening, and you know, it's early to tell still. But there is a number of outlets out there where philosophers, and there are other outlets where that are not explicitly philosophical, but they're doing something like that. For instance, I contributed one of the very first essays to Eon Magazine, which is another webzine that came out of England and it's doing very well.
Yes,
And that one is, you know, I think of that as the same kind of outlet. There is a website called Three Quarks Daily that does a similar kind of thing, where again, they're more concerned with philosophical and social issues. So there's a number of them. IO9, which is another site which deals, you know, with a very strange mix of things, including science fiction.
Yeah, you know, I read that.
That's
one.
Right. But it also,
I'm a science fiction fan.
Right,
so.
Right. But it also does deal with sort of these kind of interesting social implications of science, that sort of stuff. So,
yes.
So there's a number of these things going on. But back to your comparison with the Enlightenment, I think we should remember that even during the Enlightenment, the salons were actually not reaching that wide of an audience. You know, they were talking to the intelligentsia, what used to be called the intelligentsia. They were not talking to the non-educated person in France who was barely making a living, you know, struggling, and that eventually, of course, led to the French Revolution.
Right.
You know, just in the same way in which, unfortunately, because I do think it's unfortunate, but outlets like Ciencia Salon and similar ones, they're simply not going to talk to your average worker, American worker or housewife or whatever. It's just not, it's not going to, it cannot happen. First of all, because these people don't have the time to do that sort of thing. Because when you, you know, some people, as you know, in the United States have to hold two or three jobs just to make ends meet. So, you know, what are you going to do? You go home and turn on the computer and read Ciencia Salon? I don't think so.
Right.
But also,
right.
Of course, they don't have, you know, the educational basis for that level of discourse. And this is not, I hope it's clear that I don't mean these as any kind of insults. It's just a matter of fact. And, you know, you have to, if when you write for a certain kind of audience, that means you're implying a certain kind of, you know, a certain level of education. And unfortunately, still today in the 21st century, in one of the most technologically advanced societies in the world, we still don't have that kind of level of literacy in the general public. So I don't think we're doing any worse than the Enlightenment. And frankly, I think we're doing better because the Enlightenment didn't have the internet.
Well, that seems like a good note to end on, given that this is on an internet website. And well, I enjoyed talking with you very much, Massimo, and it was really interesting to hear your thoughts on these issues.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. Hope to talk to you soon.
See you.
Bye-bye.